pitched upon his people. They called it Juggernaut. Sir? His exec's eyes met his own, as sick as his own, and he looked past her, looked about him at his bridge officers, pictured all the other officers and ratings of Acutar's company and the dishonor he had brought upon them all. No! Zarnok lunged upright as Khon's Acutar changed course. She darted straight for the enemy, and as he watched, Kilokarn and Curve wheeled to follow her, then Fauli, Nabastar, and Zyro, until Shiasu's entire squadron streaked for the bugs behind its flagship. "Raise least claw, Shiasu!" Zarnok roared, and his comm officer punched keys. The great claw waited, watching in fury as his entire light cruiser element charged to its own destruction. And then Jwar looked up.
"Acutar does not respond, sir," he said.
Zarnok sank back into his chair, and to his watching officers it was as if he aged a century before their eyes. He gazed into his plot, watching the first missiles streak towards the light cruisers which lacked even command data link, and his ears were flat.
"Curse you, Shiasu," he thought numbly. "Curse you for doing what I long to do."
Acutar staggered as the first missile slammed into her shields. Another followed, and a third. Her shields went down, and vaporized hull plating streamed astern, yet she never slowed, never hesitated. Her own launchers fired back as she entered their range, but they were pinpricks. The bug leviathans shrugged them aside and poured a butchery of fire into Shiasu's squadron. Kilokarn blew up, then Zyro, but their sisters held their course, and Zarnok raised his open, blood-streaked hand. He thrust it towards the display, then closed it once more, digging his claws into his lacerated palm in salute, even as his soul railed at the officers who had defied his orders. Curve vanished, and beams began to fire as well. Nabastar exploded, but Acutar and Fauli continued their mad charge. They were broken wrecks, yet their drive survived, and they hurled themselves upon the enemy. A bug light cruiser accelerated to meet Fauli, and the two ships were blotted from the universe as they struck. Another light cruiser lunged at Acutar, but somehow Shiasu's ship evaded it. One ship, a single ship out of an entire squadron, charged the massive target of its foes, and Zarnok looked up, watching the visual display, as Acutar struck her target and an enemy super dreadnought blew apart in a shroud of flame.
"My claws are broken," Zarnok thought. "My honor is no more. I have failed my clan fathers and those who will follow me. I have failed my Khan. But in my dishonor, I may yet shield my Farshatok."
"Claw Darzal."
"Yes, great claw."
His flag captain's voice was quiet, and Zarnok kept his eyes on the visual display's fading ball of fire.
"Make an entry in the log, Claw Darzal. The decision to withdraw is mine, and mine alone. I did not discuss it. I did not seek the concurrence of any other officer."
"But, sir,"
Darzal began, only to stop as Zarnok raised a forestalling hand.
"Make the entry," he said softly.
Chapter 25.
May our claws strike deep.
All right, Rear Admiral Raymond Porter Prescott looked at his subordinates with grim hazel eyes. "We reach Alawan in 18 hours, and the tabbies still hold it. Our job is to make sure they continue to hold until Great Fang Karaza gets here." Commodore Diego Jackson, commanding Task Force 23's light carriers, shook his head.
"That's a tall order, sir," he said quietly.
"Maybe, but that's the mission," Prescott said, and looked at his intelligence officer. "Bring us up to speed, Eloise."
"Yes, sir." Commander Eloise Kamak had her notes on her terminal, but she didn't look at them. No doubt, Prescott thought bitterly, they were indelibly graven into her mind.
"The real surprise," she began, "is that there are any Khan units left in Alawan. Given the Orion honor code, and especially his own record, I'm amazed Great Claw Zarnak fell back at all. The fact that he's managed to preserve his battle group essentially intact is even more astounding."
As far as we can tell, he bled the bugs badly in Talmaza, but they punched a simultaneous transit into his face. He got a little too close. That's how he lost the ships he did. But for the most part, he used only his fighters. That was smart, Admiral. Very smart. They're his most replenishable resource. He was able to make good his losses in Cleon from Hairnow, and the Alawan fleet base was able to replace those he lost in Talmaza. According to our latest reports, he has 6 Orion and 3 Gorm BCs, 6 CVLs and 8 Garbag class CLs. That's not a lot, but the tabbies did well to scrape up even that much after being surprised this way. GHQ and Idnok Sector Command are trying to keep us updated on what else they may be able to find, but the situation's so confused, no one's certain what is or isn't available. Essentially, we've sent out an all-ship signal. We'll take what we can get, but for now, we and Zarnak are it. Prescott nodded slowly, for Kamak was right. It also meant his 10 battleships, 9 light carriers, 9 battle cruisers, 5 light cruisers, and 5 destroyers represented a far heavier force than Zarnak's. Not that it's heavy enough, he thought, and his mouth twisted as he remembered the 2 battleships he didn't have. TFNS Mars and Triomphant had both lost too many engine rooms to keep up on the desperate high-speed voyage from New Bristol. And he had no idea how the battlecruisers Rancour and Pikeaxe had managed to keep their drives online. Maybe these bastards have a point using commercial engines. They may suck wind in a tactical sense, but given the larger strike groups Tabby carriers carry and the partial squadrons they put aboard their capital ships, he actually has about 60 more fighters than we do, Kamak went on. Our combined force will be able to put over 300 into space, but we're very weak in capital launchers, and of course we have no SD element. If we have to fall back on the Pairsag twin planets, we'll pick up another 120 fighters, plus the fleet bases and PDC's capital launchers. But that will also mean letting the bugs range on the planets.
We're not supposed to tie ourselves down, sir, Commander Kenneth Zulu Sosa, Prescott's chief of staff, said.
I'm aware of my orders, Zulu. Prescott didn't raise his voice, but most of his staff found someplace else to look.
Every one of them knew it would be at least 2 months before Fang Korazakiniak could reach Alawan. They also knew Zarnak and Prescott were under direct orders to continue falling back until he did. What they didn't know was whether or not Prescott intended to obey those orders, and he let the silence linger, then waved for Kamak to resume.
My best appreciation is that things are going to get rougher, sir. Bug doctrine is clearly to keep pouring it on until they hit something so hard they have to stop, and the Kleon population size has to have told them they're into the Tabby's core systems. Claw Zarnak's been lucky so far in not facing any gunboats, but it's unlikely they won't bring them along for an attack on Alawan. The only good news is that they may not yet realize the Hairnow system is there. The connecting warp point's a Type 2, so it won't be too hard to find, but it's over 5 light hours out, and they've only had a couple of weeks to look for it. More importantly, Zarnak managed to destroy the ICN link to the system, so there's no Comsat breadcrumbs to lead them to it. Additionally, they know where he went. He deliberately let them track him to the Alawan warp point, so we can at least hope they've concentrated on following him up.
That was gutsy, Jason Pitnaro observed.
Prescott's flag captain was short and stocky, and his almond eyes narrowed.
There's what, 1 billion people in Alawan?
Yes, sir, but at least Alawan has some fixed defenses.
Kamak's shrug was bitter.
Sak and Alawan are supposed to be the only way into the Kleon chain. That's why both of them were fortified in the first place. But Hairnow was supposed to be covered by Alawan, so it has no local defenses, and there are 1.5 billion civilians in that system.
I didn't say it was wrong, Eloise, only that it took guts. He could have waffled and broken contact, left it to the luck of the draw. And if he loses Alawan, someone will damn sure blame him for leading the bugs to it.
He wouldn't still have a battle group if he were the waffling sort, Prescott said. Eloise is right. It's amazing he managed to hold his command together at all.
Yes, sir.
Kamak paused for a moment, then cleared her throat.
There are a couple of points to consider about the command structure, sir, she said carefully.
Such as?
Well, you're senior to Zarnak, and, well,
the intelligence officer drew a breath.
Sir, according to ONI, Zarnak hates Terrans. He may not react well when you supersede him.
I'm aware of Zarnak's attitude, Commander. Prescott's tenor voice was toneless, but it was unlike him to use formal rank titles in staff meetings, and Kamak shut her mouth. Prescott let his eyes circle the table, then spoke very slowly and deliberately.
We're not going to tell him I'm senior. Several people stiffened, whether in surprise or from a desire to protest, he didn't know, nor did it matter. This officer has been and remains under tremendous strain. He's compromised his own honor to do the right thing, the smart thing. Fang Karaz's approved his actions, and no doubt GHQ will too. But he's a tabby, an Orion from a clan whose honor has already taken a beating, and who left 4 billion of his people on their own, rather than dying in their defense. And you can bet your pensions there are other Orions who'll spit on his shadow for that. All right, he doesn't like Terrans. Well, some Terrans don't like Orions. I don't happen to be one of them, but I understand their attitude, and it's up to us to understand his. The smooth functioning of this task force in the defense of Alawan, which I remind you is also an Orion system, is our sole priority. If I can make it function more smoothly by letting him retain command, I'll do it. And given Orion traditions, I can't do it if he knows I'm senior. So understand me. Who's senior to whom stays right here in this compartment. It will not be discussed, even in casual conversation, with any other persons. Is that clear? Heads nodded soberly, and he waved a hand at Commander Alexander Lefroy. In that case, Alec, let's get to the nuts and bolts. I want contingency plans based on Zarnak's probable tactics, so we can slot into his plans with the minimum of confusion.
Yes, sir. The ops officer brought blocks of information scrolling up his terminal.
In that case, sir, the first thing to look at is the compatibility of our carrier elements, and...
Great Claw Zarnak stalked out of the Flagbridge intraship car into dead silence. He crossed to his command chair, hands folded behind his back, and stood beside it, glaring down into the repeater tank at the light dots of his reinforcements.
Humans, he thought almost despairingly. What more can the gods do to me? Not enough to take my honor. Not enough to fill me with nightmares of slaughter. No. Now they send the very Chofaki who first destroyed my clan's honor as my reinforcements.
The thought burned like acid, and his stubborn self-honesty's insistence that he should be burning incense sticks for any reinforcement only made it the worse. It was the sheerest fluke that this human Great Claw, this Prescott, had been close enough to respond. The Idnok sector had been colonized centuries ago, yet the humans had found a closed warp point within it 20 of their years before. The protocols between the two Imperiums had ceded it to the Khanate, since it lay in Zirlukuvalkanai space, yet it linked the sector to human space. Given the warp line's crazed ingeodesics, the human base at New Bristol was actually closer than any Orion base to Alawan, and this was the result. The Khan was scrambling frantically to scrape up anything it could, but this task force, this human task force, was the only organized unit available. Zarnak watched it sweep closer and tried to feel some spark of hope, some belief that, with its aid, he might hold Alawan. But there was no spark. There was only the cold, drear sense of failure which had riled him since Cleon. He shuddered, mind filled with the ugly imagery the Cleon commsats had delivered to Telmaza before the bugs drove him from it. The horrifying images of feeding bugs, proving that the Zirlukuvalkanai, too, were food for them. He closed his eyes, soul twisting in the icy wind at its center, and the stillness behind him made that wind even colder.
Do they hate me, my officers? Do they feel contempt for the coward who fell back rather than die? Do they understand why I did it? Or do they even care why? My dishonor covers them, shields their names and their clan's names. But do they fear the taint which clings to mine?
He turned away from his plot. The human commander would arrive aboard Dashir within the hour, and he must be in the boat bay to greet him. Zarnak walked from Flagbridge, and son of the Khan Thira watched him go. The Great Claw's spine was ramrod straight,
Yet Thera sensed his despair and wished he knew how to fight it. He had been shocked by the order to abandon Cleon, and he understood the horror which haunted his commander, but the great claw had been correct. Thera knew that now. Yet the way of the Zirlukuvalkanai offered no way to tell Zarnak that, and so he watched the great claw in silence, even as his heart burned to speak. Raymond Prescott stood as his cutter's hatch cycled. He and his staff had changed into summer-weight uniforms in anticipation of the tabby's shipboard temperatures, and he flicked imaginary lint from his perfectly tailored cuff. A faint fond smile curled his lips as the mannerism woke memories of his kid brother. Andy was 20 years younger, and totally unable to pass up any chance to tease him for the personal vanity he'd never quite overcome. And ever since Andy had attained captain's rank, he'd taken to teasing Raymond over his stalled career, too. Of course, promotion always slowed once an officer reached flag rank. Actually, Raymond had made captain earlier in his career than Andy had, and he was on the short list for vice admiral. But Andy had always been the feisty one, and teasing or no, Raymond wished he were here now.
No, you don't. You want him to live.
He felt his smile vanish into a grim, hard line. Then inhaled deeply and stepped forward with Commodore Jackson and Zulu Sosa at his heels. The tabby side party snapped to formal salute, and a wild, swirling keen washed over him in place of the TFN's bosun's pipes. It was inevitable, Prescott thought, that a race whose language was often described as a catfight set to bagpipes would develop real bagpipes as the favorite instrument for its martial music. Oh well, at least it makes a change. He saluted the russet-furred Great Claw, and Zarnak returned his human-style courtesy with a stiff, formal Orion salute. It was always hard to read alien facial expressions, especially when the face in question featured a blunt muzzle, shoulder-wide whiskers, and a covering of soft, plushy fur. But Prescott sensed the exhausted belligerence behind that salute. "Permission to come aboard, sir?" he asked, and saw Zarnak's whiskers twitch as the request came out in High Orion. He knew he hadn't gotten it quite right, for human vocal cords simply couldn't hit the language's higher notes, but Prescott had the rare combination of perfect pitch and the ability to imitate almost any sound, and he waited while Zarnak grappled with the sheer shock of hearing a human speak the tongue of tongues.
"Permission granted, Admiral," he replied after a moment, and Prescott lowered his hand from the salute and gestured to his subordinates.
"Allow me to present Commodore Diego Jackson, my senior carrier division CO, and Commander Sosa, my chief of staff," he said in Orion. Zarnak bowed to each of them in turn, then rested one hand on the shoulder of the slender female officer beside him.
96th Least Claw, Dars Alharainan, my flag captain," he said, and waited while Sosa translated for Jackson, whose grasp of Orion was poor, to say the least.
The flag captain returned Prescott's bow, and he reminded himself that a con flag officer's flag captain was also his chief of staff. He was unfamiliar with Clan Herna. No non-Orion could keep their sprawling clan structures straight. But Darsal's pelt was the sable of the oldest Orion nobility, and she also wore the starburst of the Valkaner Ziger, the equivalent of the Solar Cross, along with several lesser decorations. Not just an aristocrat, but a good one, he thought. The Orion patriarchal culture had persisted well into its interstellar stage, and even today, female Orion officers, regardless of birth rank, had to be a cut better than their male peers if they expected to advance. Darsal, it appeared, was no exception to the rule.
"If you would accompany us," Zarnak said, "my staff is waiting to brief you."
He paused, then continued more stiffly.
"I regret that there is insufficient time to greet you with a proper meal, Admiral, but—"
He broke off with an earflick shrug, and Prescott nodded. "I understand, sir," he said, and followed Zarnak and Darsal to the intraship car.
"So while we are not positive of the enemy's strength or plans," Thera Jihal finished his brief, "the addition of your carriers will let us mount a much stronger combat space patrol on the warp point.
We do not know if we will be able actually to hold this system. Certainly we intend to try. The Sak fortresses rely upon the Pyrsag twins for support and maintenance. If we lose Alawan, we lose that support. More to the point, there are 1 billion civilians on the twins. And, of course, every system we lose is one more we must retake before we can relieve Cleon.
Zarnok kept his expression impassive as he watched his new allies' flat, naked faces. For the first time in his life, he wished he had made a serious study of them. He suspected this Admiral Prescott was skilled at evaluating Orion expressions, and that irked him. Human faces were far more mobile than he had previously appreciated, yet he was unable to interpret their mobility. He watched Commodore Jackson as Sosa murmured a translation of Thera's remarks into his flat, round ear, and felt another flicker of resentment as the commander's translation re-emphasized Prescott's ability to speak the tongue of tongues. It was convenient, but what business had a Chofot learning the tongue of warriors? And why had he bothered? It could not have been easy, given the differences in their vocal apparatuses, so why take the trouble? Now Prescott glanced at Jackson and raised an eyebrow. The Commodore nodded, confirming his understanding of Thera's presentation, and the Admiral looked at Zarnak. "I believe I understand your intention, sir," he said, still in the tongue of tongues, curse it. "And we can adjust our operations to conform with them. Commander Sosa has brought along chips detailing our current readiness states and comm procedures. We will, of course, adapt our own protocols to yours, and with your permission, I will send Commander Lefroy, my own operations officer, to Dashir for more detailed conversations with the son of the Khan Thera." Zarnak flicked his ears in approval, but then his eyes narrowed as Prescott leaned back. Familiar with human body language or not, the Great Claw recognized the look of someone about to suggest changes, and something inside him bristled in instant resentment. But he made himself wait. Chofok or no, this human's task force was more powerful than his own. If Prescott wished to make suggestions, Zarnak had no option but to listen, however stupid they might be. "One point which has not been discussed," Prescott said, "is that of equipment compatibility. As you know, our data link is unable to mate with your own. This is unfortunate, and I understand your R&D people are working with our own to correct the problem, though it will not help us here. The point I would like to offer for your consideration, however, sir, are the differences in our munitions, and particularly our fighter ordnance." Zarnak felt a fresh prickle of surprise at the human's calm, respectful tone, and raised one hand, palm uppermost and claws retracted, to invite him to continue. "A support echelon from New Bristol will join us here as soon as possible, but the yard ships and freighters are slower than our warships and left later. They will not arrive for 3 more of our weeks, and the ordnance currently on hand is all we will have for that time. We were aware this would be true, so we have filled our own cargo holds with additional missiles which I would like to transship to your fleet base. That would get them out of harm's way, and we can re-ammunition from the space stations following any engagement." He paused, and Zarnak flicked an ear in agreement. That much, at least, was simple enough, but the human was not yet done. "Turning to the matter of fighter ordnance, our carriers can recover and launch one another's fighters. We cannot rearm your fighters, however, nor you ours. What I would suggest is that we redistribute our ordnance and life support modules. If we were to transfer, say, half of our missiles, frams, and life support pods to your carriers and replace them with your hardware, it would be possible for any carrier to support any fighter squadron. Not only would this increase our tactical flexibility, but it would give us greater platform survivability through redundancy." It was all Zarnak could do to keep his jaw from dropping. The human's Orion was not perfect. He seemed incapable of reaching the proper notes for full emphasis, and his grammar was overly formal. Yet that meant nothing beside what he had just suggested. The Great Claw glanced at Darsal, seeing his flag captain's surprise and approval at the offer, and wondered why it had not occurred to him to make the same suggestion. "Perhaps it was because you let hatred blind you," he thought unwillingly. "Yet the offer has merit, great merit." He gathered himself to speak, but before he could, Commodore Jackson leaned forward.
His speech was incomprehensible to the Great Claw. I must learn to understand them, after all. Chofaki or not, they are our allies, and it seems they may have something worthwhile to say after all.
There's one other point I'd like to mention, sir, the Commodore said. The Persag fleet base has a powerful fighter component, and it occurred to us during our discussions en route to Alawan that it might be worthwhile to consider staging those fighters through our carriers. With tenders and full life support loads, they could make the flight to us well outside their theoretical range, and we could arm them once they arrive.
Zarnak looked at Thera. His ops officer and he had discussed the same possibility, but without a decision. Their carriers would have been badly overextended, trying to support so many fighters, but if they adopted Prescott's suggestion about ordnance loads, it would be possible. It would also strip the Persag twins of local fighter defenses, yet it would increase his own fighter strength, and hence his chance of actually holding the system, by almost 50%. Thera looked back, then flicked his ears, and Zarnak returned his gaze to Prescott.
I believe these suggestions have merit, Admiral.
It irked him that he still sounded faintly begrudging, and he made himself add,
It is a generous offer, and I thank you for it.
If my claws guard not your back, then whose claws shall guard mine? The Admiral said softly, and Zarnak experienced yet another flicker of surprise at this human's command of the tongue of tongues. How many years must he have studied the Zirlukuvalkanai to have attained such insight into them? And again, why had he bothered? The Great Claw felt a nagging suspicion he would not like the answer to that question if he knew it. Not because Prescott had done so with sinister intent, but because... He shook the thought aside. There would be time to consider it later, assuming any of them survived, and he pushed his chair back on its powered track and stood.
"Very well, Admiral," he said. "I approve your suggestions. Son of the Khan Thera and Least Claw Darsal will hold themselves in readiness to discuss the details with your Commander Lafroy. In the meantime," he hesitated, then made himself extend his hand in the human manner. "Welcome to Alawan. May our claws strike deep."
"May our claws strike deep," the human agreed, and gripped his hand firmly. Chapter 26. There are no Chofaki here. Zarnak looked up as his intelligence officer entered the briefing room. 19th Least Claw Wari Salathan was young for her rank, especially as a female, but Zarnak had specifically requested her. She was a bit of a maverick, which scarcely endeared her to some superiors, yet she was also brilliant and the daughter of an old friend. And, he admitted with what he knew was old-fashioned sexism, she was most pleasant to look upon as well. But now her expression caused him to put his display on hold, halting the play of the latest tactical plan Thera and the human Lafroy had worked out.
"Yes, Yuaria? I have just learned something which should be drawn to your attention, Great Claw," she said, with rather more than normal formality, and his ears pricked. "As you know, I requested background files on Admiral Prescott and his senior officers from the Eyes of the Khan. I remember, not that they told us much." "No, sir, but my request was bucked up to GHC in Centauri, and the humans provided the information we lacked."
"They did?" Zarnak was surprised. It remained difficult not to think automatically of humans as Chofaki, though he was being forced, to some extent, to modify his opinion, as Prescott's task force shook down as TG-37.2 of the Grand Alliance's newly designated Task Force 37. Even so, he would not have expected their navy to provide such data.
"Yes, sir."
Waria seemed almost to squirm, then sighed.
"Great Claw, he is senior to you."
"He..." Zarnak sat as if struck to stone. Senior to him? The human was senior to him? Impossible. Surely he would have said something. But Waria did not make such mistakes.
"Are you positive?" he asked finally.
Waria's ears flicked, and Zarnak's thoughts floundered. If Prescott was senior, why had he not said so? Why had he always addressed Zarnok as Sir and accepted Zarnok's plans? He looked back up at Warya. Young or no, she was a shrewd judge of character, and unlike Zarnok, she had studied humans as part of her intelligence training.
"Have you any theory as to why he has not told us so? Could he be unaware of the fact?"
"I doubt his ignorance, sir," Warya said carefully.
"Admiral Prescott is clearly a student of our people. I feel certain he requested your dossier before reporting to Alawan."
"Then why?" Zarnok asked, and his eyes narrowed as the Least Claw hesitated.
"Speak your thoughts, Least Claw," he said firmly, and she sighed once more.
"Great Claw, I think he knows your feeling for his people," she said softly. "I believe he chose to accept your authority because of it."
Zarnok leaned back in a welter of chaotic emotions, astonishment, confusion, and shame. If Warya was right, Prescott had deliberately renounced a command authority to which he was entitled. One of the Zirluku Valkanai might do such a thing, but only under very special circumstances which did not apply here. Part of the Great Claw longed to put it down to cowardice, to a Chofak's desire to avoid responsibility, yet he had been forced to work too closely with Prescott over the last 10 days to believe that. No, he knew what the truth had to be. Prescott had done what he himself could not. The human had sacrificed honor to the prejudices of another, accepting a lesser role, obedient to one he had the right to command, because he knew his legal subordinate hated his race. And he had not done so openly, lest it underscore the Great Claw's prejudice and so dishonor Zarnok.
"I am sorry, Great Claw," Warya said, "yet I thought you should know I—"
"No, Warya," Zarnok said quietly.
"You did well in this. It is I who have done poorly."
"You have much on your mind and spirit," the Least Claw protested in his defense.
"Not enough to excuse insult to an ally," Zarnok replied,
and fresh surprise filled him as he realized he meant it, that it was not simply the mouthing of a formality.
"There is no insult, sir," Warya argued. "There would be insult only had you known."
"Which I now do," Zarnok pointed out.
He looked back down at the frozen display and sighed.
"Very well, Warya. Thank you. I shall calm Admiral Prescott and—"
He never finished the sentence, for even as he spoke, the alarms began to scream.
"They're coming through, sir,"
Sosa reported as Prescott charged onto Flagbridge.
"Simultaneous transit, 40-plus CLs, but they seem weak in cataphracts."
"Thank God for small favors, Zulu," Prescott muttered, and his mouth tightened as his plot confirmed Sosa's estimate.
It also showed him something else, and his mouth tightened further as the first gunboat icons began to appear.
"Claw Zarnok's activated Alpha 3,
Lafroy said. That wasn't what the tabbies called it, of course, but it was a designation humans could pronounce, and Prescott nodded.
"Acknowledge."
He punched a stud, and Diego Jackson's face appeared on his screen.
"Alpha 3, Diego," he said without preamble, wishing yet again that it had been possible to integrate TF-37's comnet more fully.
"Roll 'em out."
The assault fleet made transit with the leading gunboats. There were no energy buoys to flail them this time, a fringe benefit of pressing the enemy so hard. But there were sufficient mines to delay the light cruisers, which survived transit. The enemy attack craft came slashing in, intent on killing the CLEs before their systems stabilized, and the gunboats went to meet them. The gunboats were bigger, more vulnerable targets, but this time there were no jammer buoys to break their data nets, and while the attack craft were more heavily armed, their internal energy weapons could bear only directly ahead of them. The gunboat's internal lasers, however, had a command of over 270 degrees, and their point defense systems had even more coverage. A dozen of them died in the first pass, but four ship squadrons fired back at the attack craft driving in on them. Coupled with the cruiser's weapons, they killed at least as many enemy units for the loss of only 7 CLEs, and that was a worthwhile exchange. The enemy had more carriers this time, yet none of his larger ones. He could not have many attack craft to expend.
"Their gunboats are more effective than expected, Great Claw," Fira reported tersely. "Our CSP has lost heavily, but we have accounted for all but two cataphracts."
"Here come the humans, sir," Darsal said.
Zarnok's eyes flicked back to his plot. Jackson's squadron swooped past the survivors of his CSP, armed with missiles, not Fram's. They opened fire from beyond the bug's range, and Zarnok snarled as fireballs glared. The gunboat's point defense might make them resistant to missile fire, but not resistant enough.
"The cruisers are moving into the mines," Thera said,
and then the ops officer's ears went flat.
"Here come the super dreadnoughts."
The super dreadnoughts made transit in a tight chain. There were but 38, for the fleet was still redeploying to exploit this axis. Yet there were no enemy super dreadnoughts. Once his attack craft were gone, the battle line would roll forward unstoppably. Prescott watched Jackson's squadrons tear into the gunboats, but the cruisers were clearing the mines. There simply hadn't been time to emplace enough of them, and it looked like at least some light units would survive to screen the main force. "The Tabbies are launching their reserve strike," Lafroy reported. "Has Zarnok alerted the fleet base, Zulu?"
"Yes, sir. The message went out,"
Sosa checked a time display.
8 minutes ago."
Prescott grunted in approval, not that any of the fleet base fighters could reach them in time to stop the enemy from making transit. The Persag twins were currently on the far side of Alawan from the warp point. It would take the alert message 4 hours to reach the fleet base, and the fighters would have needed a full day to make the flight out. That was beyond their range, even with full life support loads. But Thera and Lafroy had arranged a resupply point with the orbital base's tenders. All they could do was replenish the fighters' life support, but that doubled their range. By the time TF-37 fell back to them, they'd be ready to stage through the carriers.
"And we're going to have plenty of spare hangar space," the Admiral thought grimly,
as the Tabbies hurtled in to attack the leading super dreadnoughts and the flashes of dying fighters speckled the visual display. The Orions broke through to salvo their Frams, and 5 archers blew up. Yet their consorts caught the Tabbies in a crossfire between their own weapons and the gunboats, and Zarnok's pilots paid heavily for their success.
"They've cleared a lane, sir," Lafroy said flatly. "They're breaking out."
The fleet uncoiled directly towards the enemy starships, and those ships gave ground. They retreated steadily, remaining beyond missile range and sending in their attack craft again and again. But the battle line forged remorselessly ahead. Battlecruisers and the remaining light cruisers screened the super dreadnoughts against the attackers, and the enemy shifted targeting. He had no choice, for he must blow a gap through the screen just to reach the battle line.
"They are no longer sending gunboats to meet our fighters, Great Claw."
Thera sounded concerned, and Zarnok understood. The bugs were saving their gunboats until his fighter strength was blunted. His pilots were his best defense against them. Only after his strike groups had been whittled away would the enemy commit them against his starships.
"Fighter losses?" he asked sharply.
42% of our own carriers. The human loss rate is somewhat lower. I estimate they have lost perhaps 30%.
Zarnok flicked his ears in acknowledgement. The human losses might be lower, but not because they were avoiding action. Their squadrons had not been harrowed by his own earlier losses in Cleon and Talmaza, and their experience showed. Even his carrier commanders admitted they were as good as any Khan strike groups, and they were spending themselves more wisely than his own Farshatok. Yet they fought as furiously as if it were human worlds they defended. If only the bugs had fewer screening units. His strikes were costing their escorts dear, yet aside from that initial pass, only 3 super dreadnoughts had been destroyed.
"Inform Farshakhanak Liak that he is to maintain a reserve of at least 20%. We dare not reduce our CSP below that."
"Yes, Great Claw," Thera replied,
and Zarnok looked at his comm officer.
"Message from the flag, sir."
Prescott turned his command chair at the comm officer's announcement and waited. "Tango 3 Delta, sir."
Acknowledge. Prescott looked at Lefroy. Pass the order, Alec. 14 battlecruisers, 3 Orion, 3 Gorm, 8 Terran, advanced against the enemy. The Gorm and Orion BCs were TF-37's only true capital missile ships, for the Terran broadswords were configured primarily for closer action. They were attached solely to support and protect their longer-ranged allies, and as they closed, a fresh fighter strike went past them. Massed squadrons, half Terran and half Orion, tore down on the surviving bug screen, and this time a heavy fire of SBMs came with them from the Allied battlecruisers' external racks. The bugs could use their point defense to stop missiles or fighters, not both, and ship after ship blew apart. Yet the success came with a price. Another 40 fighters were blasted out of space, and the battlecruiser's attack had brought them in reach of the surviving archers. Missile salvos roared back and forth, matching super-dreadnought shields and armor against the frailer battlecruiser's superior point defense. And then a fresh wave of fighters slashed in. This time some of the gunboats came out once more, but not to engage fighters. Instead, they hurled themselves straight at the battlecruisers, and cursing Orion and Terran squadron commanders diverted from their anti-shipping strike to claw around in pursuit. They caught a dozen, but the rest got by. The battlecruisers went to evasive action, firing furiously, and the Terran ships maneuvered between the gunboats and their allies, for the missile ships were weak in energy weapons. Two-thirds of the bugs were blown apart. The other third got through, and they brought a surprise with them. They didn't have FRAMs, but their R&D had produced the cruder nuclear-armed FR, and a gunboat carried 3 times as many as a fighter. TFNS Arrow, Ransour, and Partisan died as the gunboats poured fire into them. Scimitar and the command ship Constitution took heavy damage of their own, and despite all they could do, GSN Balziac fell astern, crippled and lamed. Great Claw Zarnak watched the icons vanish. Once he would have felt only vengeful satisfaction at human deaths. Now he watched them dying like Farshartok, deliberately drawing the enemy onto themselves to protect Orion ships. Dying under the orders of an Orion who was not even truly the senior officer of TF-37. What now, Zarnak? The question seared through him. Who knows the truth of honor? Those who die to defend their people, or those who die to protect another's? The fleet ground onward. The enemy's battlecruisers had suffered heavily. They had finished off the fleet's battlecruisers and 2 more super-dreadnoughts as well, yet 3 missile super-dreadnoughts survived, and nothing the enemy had left could engage them. The rest of the fleet formed around them, continuing its remorseless advance, and the enemy's attack craft came in ever weaker waves. Soon it would be time to commit the gunboats once more. Raymond Prescott scrubbed a hand across exhaustion-sore eyes. The battle had raged for almost 2 days, and losses were heavy on both sides. Heavier for the bugs, but losses were always heavier for the bugs, and never seemed to stop them. So far, TF-37 had destroyed 63 cruisers and battlecruisers and 11 super-dreadnoughts, but that left 27 super-dreadnoughts, including those damned archers. TF-37's fighters had been too weakened to get through to them, and even if they hadn't, killing them at this point would do little good. The whole point in killing archers was to clear the way for Allied capital missiles and SBMs, and of TF-37's missile ships, only 2 Gorm Bolzuchas were still combat-capable. Their strike groups had suffered too heavily to take more losses, trying for the archers now, anyway, for their original 340 fighters had been reduced to 88, only 50 of them Terran. He checked the time display again. 11 more hours. The fleet base's fighters were already en route, and in about 11 hours, the bugs were going to get a surprise when 150 fresh fighters exploded into their faces. It was time. The enemy's attack craft strikes had all but ceased. His strength must be nearly exhausted. And the order went out. For just a moment, the exhausted plotting officers didn't believe their own instruments. But they had to. And frantic orders crackled as 230 bug gunboats and small craft screamed towards the Allied starships.
Scratch-built squadrons, assembled out of the remnants of TF-37's original strike groups, launched to meet them. But the attack roared in, and only Zarnok's order to maintain a reserve gave TF-37 a chance. The strength of his carefully husbanded fighters took the bugs by surprise, and gunboats and kamikazes, which had been targeted on battleships, were diverted to the carriers, lest still more fighters launch from them. The Allied pilots were exhausted, their original squadron organizations long since wrecked. Pilots flew with whatever wingmen they could find, and Terrans and Orions streaked into the enemy together, flushing missiles into the gunboats, then closed with their lasers. They carved a river of fire through their enemies, but the bugs outnumbered them more than 3-1. Half died in the first pass, and even as they looped back, the remaining gunboats abandoned the slower antimatter-loaded cutters to streak ahead under maximum power. Zarnok saw it coming, and there was nothing he could do. The human carriers were better protected, for their smaller fighter groups and more advanced shields let them build in twice the defensive power of an Orion CVL. And Prescott's task group included a dozen CLEs and DDEs. But those escorts could not data link with the Orion carriers. They did their best to protect their allies, yet good as it was, their best was not enough. Defensive fire killed dozens of gunboats, but others tore through the formation, ignoring its battleships. More than half went after the Terran Shokakus, but only a handful of those got through. Four of the TFN carriers were damaged, yet none were hurt critically. Not so the Khan. The bugs broke through their lighter defenses in strength, salvoing their close attack weapons and following their missiles in to ram. Butnothin, Burkan, and Falkirk were destroyed outright, and Bathyr and Firmiak took heavy damage. Every Orion carrier was hit, most badly, and engine rooms became infernos as kamikazes sent power surges ripping through abused drive fields. They fell out of formation while frantic engineers fought their damage, and Zarnok stared at the ruin of his carriers. His own task group had been gutted. Only its light cruisers and three battle cruisers remained combat capable, and that was far too little to stave off the juggernaut rolling down on his lamed carriers. The surviving fighters, all 30 of them, finished off the kamikazes before they completed the CVL's destruction. Yet he knew what he must do. He fought against it, but he had no choice, and he opened his mouth to order Prescott to abandon the doomed carriers and take his own command to meet the fleet base's fighters. "The tabby carriers are hurt bad, sir." Alec Lefroy's fingers pressed his earbud as if to screw it bodily inside his head, and he grimaced. "Damage control's on it, but they need at least 20 minutes to get back enough drive rooms to stay away from the bugs." Prescott stared into his plot, eyes hard as the mind behind them whirred. Only 18 Terran fighters survived, and his carriers hadn't gotten off unscathed. They had about 80 bays left, but over 150 fighters were coming in from the fleet base. More to the point, those fighters were Orion, and despite the transfers, his carriers were desperately short of tabby ordnance after 2 exhausting days of battle. If they lost the surviving Orion fighter platforms, they wouldn't have the weapons to arm the fleet base's fighters once they got here. "We've got to buy those ships some time," he said flatly.
"Sir, we don't have any orders from the flag," Sosa pointed out.
Prescott glanced at him, and the chief of staff looked back. The ex-fighter jock didn't like saying that, but it was his job to serve as his admiral's tactical conscience.
"I realize that, Zulu," Prescott said softly.
"Sir, Great Claw, the humans!"
Zarnak's head snapped around at the semi-coherent shout, and his jaw dropped in disbelief. TG-37.2 was moving, not to break off as he had intended to order, but to interpose between the bugs and his carriers. It was insane. Prescott's battleships mounted only a single capital missile launcher each, and that only to deploy defensive missiles. He could engage the enemy only from within the bug's own weapons envelope, and he had battleships, not super dreadnoughts. Even as he watched, the first missiles roared out, and capital force beams began to fire. The human's data-linked point defense blunted the missile salvos, but it could do nothing about energy weapons,
and shields flashed and died as the suicidal pounding match began.
"Zuar, order Prescott to break off!"
"Yes, Great Claw," the comm officer spoke urgently into his pickup, then stiffened.
"Sir, Admiral Prescott refuses." "Give me a direct link."
Prescott's face appeared on Zarnak's comm screen instantly, and the Great Claw forced his voice to come out flat and level.
"Break off, Admiral."
"I must respectfully decline, sir," Prescott replied, and actually smiled as Zarnak's ears flattened in consternation. The image flickered as missiles and beams pounded the Admiral's flagship, and Prescott shook his head in the human gesture of negation. "You need those carriers. My own have too few weapons to support the fleet base's fighters."
"This is madness. You sacrifice your ships for nothing."
"My claws are yours, and your cause is just," the human said softly. "There is no dishonor in death, and no honor in flight." Zarnak could not hide his shock as Prescott quoted the warrior's way. They were the final words of Shasahir Tolkien, he who first formalized the Farshalakia, second only to Krana Tolnatha among the fathers in honor of the Zirlukuvalkani. And even as Zarnak stared at him, the human cut the circuit. The Great Claw dropped his eyes to the plot, and his fists clenched as the outnumbered, outgunned humans engaged their foes. Shields flashed and died, warheads and beams ripped at hull plating. Prescott's battle line was trapped in the heart of a furnace, and still it held its ground, drawing the enemy's fury down upon itself while the carrier crews fought to repair their drives. A battleship died, then another. A battlecruiser followed them, and Prescott's flagship shuddered as her own shields went down. Armor shattered under the pounding beams, yet no human ship turned away. They stood and died at their admiral's side, thundering back at their massive enemies for 5 minutes, 8, 10. For 12 endless, terrible minutes they held alone until the surviving Orion carriers were able to get back underway. Then, and only then, they too began to pull away from the enemy once more. But 4 battleships and 3 more battle cruisers of the Terran Federation Navy had died. Every surviving ship was damaged, some critically. Yet Raymond Prescott had done what he set out to do, and Zarnak Diano would never think of humans in the same way again. The fleet continued its pursuit until a sudden infusion of fresh attack craft assailed it. The enemy battleships had inflicted damage out of all proportion to their relatively small size, and the fresh attack craft struck at the worst possible moment. There were few gunboats left, and the fleet, busy reorganizing its crippled data groups, was caught unprepared. 6 already damaged super dreadnoughts succumbed to a blizzard of frams. Several of those which survived were badly wounded, and the fleet called off the pursuit. It knew where the enemy was headed, after all, and it also knew reinforcements were en route.
"The scanner buoys confirm it, Great Claw," Least Claw Darsal said wearily. 24 additional super dreadnoughts have joined the enemy. At present rate of advance, they will enter range of the twins in 71 hours.
"Escorts?" Zarnak Diano asked.
30 battle cruisers and approximately 50 light cruisers," Darsal said flatly. "They appear to be accompanied by many additional gunboats as well."
"I see." Zarnak drew a deep breath and closed his eyes. 5 days had passed since the first attack withdrew, and he'd let himself hope. Now that hope died.
"Has Admiral Prescott been informed?"
"They were his sensor buoys, sir," Darsal said with a flick of weary humor, and Zarnak's own ears twitched in bittersweet amusement.
"Human technology," he thought. "Must they always be better than we?"
"Your orders, Great Claw,"
his flag captain asked, and Zarnak shrugged.
"There will be no retreat this time," he said.
"Lord Kiniak will not arrive for another month. If Great Claw Irnar's fortresses can hold Sak until he arrives, his force should be powerful enough to retake Alawan."
But if the bugs can take Sak first, or even mount a warp point defense of Alawan in strength, he will pay heavily to break in. I know only one way to weaken them for him, and I doubt the enemy realizes how powerful the fixed defenses are. Between us, the bases and our ships can cripple this force before we are destroyed. Perhaps even inflict sufficient delay to prevent an invasion of the twins before Lord Kiniak relieves them.
And the humans? Darsal pressed in a gentle voice.
I will not insult their honor, Zarnok said softly. The flag captain gazed at him a moment longer, then nodded, saluted, and withdrew without another word.
Zarnok returned to his terminal, staring sightlessly at the reports which had just become so meaningless, then cleared the screen and brought up a visual of TF-37's battered remnants. 11 wounded light carriers, only 3 of them Orion, hung in orbit about the twin planets, supported by 6 damaged battleships, all human, and 11 battlecruisers, 3 of them human. With the missile batteries of the fleet base and the PDCs, they would give a good account of themselves. Yet they were doomed. Zarnok knew it, and he knew Prescott knew it. But the human had not even suggested the withdrawal of his units. Horned Viper had been hit hard in her stand against the enemy battle line. Commander Sosa was dead. Commander Kamak was badly wounded. And Prescott himself had suffered minor wounds to the head and leg. Many of his other ships had been damaged as well, and unlike Zarnak ships, none of them could tie into the massive point defense nets provided by the PDCs. It did not matter. The human support ships had not yet arrived, yet Prescott's exhausted crews had torn into their repairs with what limited help the fleet-based technicians could provide. Most of their shields had been restored, many of their weapons had been put back online, and the munitions Prescott had offloaded earlier had sufficed to refill their surviving magazines. Yet their armor was riddled, and their repairs were fragile. It would take little fresh pounding to put them back out of action. But Raymond Prescott would not abandon the Persag twins. As Zarnak, he knew relief could not arrive in time, but that every enemy ship destroyed killing his own vessels would be one less to bombard the twins or contest Lord Kiniak's entry into Alawan.
And like me, he cannot abandon still more civilians. A warrior could do worse than die with such chofaki, the Great Claw thought wearily. And as Prescott himself said, there is no dishonor in death and no honor in flight. "Here they come, sir," Jason Pitnaro said softly, and Prescott nodded.
His flag bridge was a shambles, but his only other command battleship had been destroyed outright, so he'd moved himself and Alec Lefroy onto Horned Viper's command deck. Now he rubbed the bandage on the shaved half of his skull, watching the master plot's ominous icons, and pictured the civil defense plans springing into purposeful and ultimately futile action on the Persag twins. He doubted the bugs even began to suspect how powerful the local defenses were. But when they found out, it was going to be ugly. No doubt the PDCs would draw a heavy bombardment, which was why the Federation seldom mounted offensive weapons on inhabited worlds. And once the bugs realized what they faced, they would abandon any plan to come in piecemeal and throw everything they had straight at the huge, heavily armed fleet base, and what was left of TF-37.
"Glad you weren't here after all, Andy," he thought, then smiled crookedly at Dashir's icon. "For a bigot, you're not too shabby, Zarnak Diano. I suppose a man could do worse."
"How long, Alec?" he asked.
7 hours," Lefroy replied, and Prescott astonished himself with a chuckle.
"Right on our original projection," he observed. "Remind me to congratulate CIC."
"Of course, sir,"
Pitnaro said with a small smile of his own, and they returned their attention to the plot as the minutes leaked away. The bugs slid closer and closer, inching towards engagement range, and then suddenly they stopped. Prescott straightened in his chair. He hissed as his wounded leg protested the movement, but it was a distant pain. There was no reason for them to stop. They'd advanced across the system for days,
and the one thing Bugs didn't do was hesitate about committing to action. But they were hesitating, and then, as abruptly as they'd stopped advancing, they turned away. All of them turned away.